Has any war in history gone according to plan? Monarchs, dictators, and elected leaders alike have a terrible record on military decision-making. From overambitious goals to ignoring intelligence, terrain, or enemy capabilities. This leads to needless deaths and widespread destruction, while also failing to achieve geopolitical objectives and usually lays the seeds for more wars down the line. So how can wars be fought effectively to minimize loss of life and guarantee lasting peace? Welcome to Afterwards. I'm Roger Boys, diplomatic editor and foreign affairs columnist for The Times, and joining me today is Mike Martin, former army officer, author, and senior visiting research fellow in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. His latest book, How to Fight a War, is a crisp, indispensable guide to understanding modern warfare. In it, Mike outlines the logic behind fighting a conclusive interstate war that solves geopolitical problems and reduces future conflict. So, Mike, thank you very much for joining us. So, you say you write this for aspiring commanders in chief. Of course, we do that with your tongue in cheek, since we know that a lot of commanders in chief don't actually read books. But, anyway, it's. But in a way, I think we've all become armchair generals thanks to the Ukraine war. You know, even the average Joe has become quite alert to some of the features of this particular war. So what do you think has changed in the way that land war has been fought over the years? Is this a different, I mean, it seems to have very common characteristics to other wars, but there are fundamental differences, aren't there? Could you outline some of those for me and what that changes in the way we will see land war in the future?
I actually don't think the fundamentals of warfare have changed at all. It's quite a common view that, and it happens every time there's a war, people say, oh, well, you know, this war's happened, and therefore all those ideas we had about warfare, we need to junk them and come up with a new set of ideas. But fundamentally, war, you know, whether it's 10,000 years ago, throwing rocks and maybe spears at each other, to what we're seeing now, you know, with hypersonic missiles and drones and all the rest of it, fundamentally, it is at its basis that psychological contest for dominance, using violence as a way of changing your opponent's mind, means that we see the same dynamic. You know, we see attack, retreat, bluff, deceive, rout, all of these dynamics that we see in Ukraine, we also saw at the Battle of Thermopylae. And that's, you know, one of the main reasons why, if you go and study to be a soldier, an officer, or even if you're a historian, people go and do battlefield tours of battles that are thousands of years old, but the same dynamics are at play, whether it's 10,000 years ago or whether it's now. Now, I think what has changed, obviously, is technology. What tends to happen with technology is that, come back to Ukraine, everyone said, oh, well, we've got all these drones now, so tanks are useless, and we need to think about armies without tanks. But that's not correct. We need tanks because we need infantry. And you need infantry because war is about people. And ultimately, if you want to win a war, you need to stick your people with weapons into someone else's city or village or whatever. And if you've got infantry, you need tanks because tanks protect infantry. So the lesson to learn from drones is not get rid of tanks. The lesson is design better anti-drone defenses for the tanks that you already have. And so with technology, you tend to see these arms races, and that might shift the balance on the battlefield one way or the other until the other side catches up. But fundamentally, war is still this psychological contest. And so in that sense, it doesn't change. It's just the same as it always has been.
But doesn't it accelerate war? You can fix targets at a much faster rate now, and maybe doesn't it also improve accuracy and precision?
It does, and it particularly communications technology. So that's often people don't think about, when they think about technology more, they might think of tanks or missiles or whatever. But actually, something really, really fundamental is how different echelons and how different layers of command communicate with each other. So obviously, we've had carrier pigeon, messenger, semaphore flag, so on and so forth. Up until now, we have multi-networked encrypted data systems that are able to acquire targets on one side of the battlefield, whiz it over to another weapon system on the other side of the battlefield to destroy it. And that's all true. It speeds up war. And we're able to do it at a much greater distance, of course, now as well. The range that we can fight wars is global, essentially, now. But still, fundamentally, at the moment, we still have human beings making decisions. And what we're trying to do with all of these weapon systems, no matter how, at what range or how fast we're trying to do it, is we're trying to affect the psychology of the opposing team and particularly the opposing commander.
Is that not what we're seeing in Ukraine too? When we talk about a nimble army, is that because of this acceleration, or is it because that's the way they've always been?
The dichotomy you're describing between a sort of very centralized army that's hierarchical and one that has more decentralized nodes of decision-making is broadly the difference between Russia, which is very hierarchical, and Ukraine, which is much less hierarchical and has benefited from the last decade of working and being trained by Western troops. It does require a different type of soldier. It requires one that's much better trained, often has a much better base layer of education because they're having to take into account more information, process it, make decisions upon it. And what it does is it enables decisions to be made faster. And it also means that each commander, let's say it's a lieutenant, right? And you've got 10 lieutenants. They're all going to make slightly different decisions based on what they're doing in their locality or what the situation is in their locality, which means at the end, it's very difficult for the enemy to respond to that because they're going to have 10 slightly different variations on what's going on. This idea of decentralized command style is called mission command, or the Brits call it mission command. And it largely came out of the armored warfare of the Second World War. So it was a little bit of the Second World War, and it certainly accelerated during the Cold War. It's not totally decentralized, but what you do is you give people their objectives, their goals. You say, you must destroy that enemy position. But how they do it is up to them. And that enables this initiative and response to what's going on, and they're able to act much more quickly. Compare and contrast it to the Russians, where if the set of orders doesn't match the situation you've got, you go up the chain of command and all the way back down again because the person at the top has to make the decision. And that's obviously much, much slower. And it's really the only thing you can do if you've got an army like Russia's has, which is full of conscripts or people who are mobilized, low levels of training, low morale. They're not equipped to be able to take the initiative in modern warfare. And so they can't. They just have to rely on their hierarchical chain of command.
You have a very interesting chapter about morale as well in the book. And it does seem to me that that's, or at least at the beginning, there is a linkage, isn't there, between morale in a supposedly rapidly advancing invading army and homeland defense, and also a linkage between the quality of morale and the quality of logistics. Wouldn't you say that it's all somehow weirdly linked up?
I think there were probably three problems for the Russians at the beginning when it came to their morale. Firstly, they weren't supplied logistically. And actually, that's probably the least of their problems. Mm. I think the other two things are probably more important. One is the narrative around the war, right? And people like to fight for a reason. If they're going to put their lives at stake, they like to fight for a reason. And there was a huge mismatch between the reason they were told they were going to Ukraine, which was, oh, they're basically Russian guys. We just need to go and liberate them. Their government is full of neo-Nazis and homosexuals and all the rest of it. And that immediately, as soon as those Russian troops came into contact with the Ukrainian citizens, who said, we don't want you here, go home, or something ruder, they immediately, that whole narrative started to crumble. And so that, we start to quit, well, hang on a minute, why are we here? And then I think there's a more philosophical underpinning, which is that for good morale, the military, the government, and the population need to be broadly in agreement about what it is that they're doing when they're fighting war. Again, because war is expensive, people lose their lives, you know, from the population, all the mothers and fathers losing their sons and daughters. So it's a huge emotional strain on society fighting the war. And if the government, the population and the military all have slightly different ideas about what's going on. That's very hard for the military to fight because does the population support them? Does the government support us? Well, it doesn't really care about our casualties. So maybe that there's definitely that mismatch as well in the way that the Russians pursued the war. And I think it's not just the beginning. I think those problems have continued. Mm. I think we've seen instances of Russian soldiers surrendering. We've seen Russian soldiers trying to run away. There have been all sorts of problems for the Russians from the point of view of morale, which is why they've had to rely on very, very heavy hand discipline. Like I just gave examples of soldiers running away. Some of those deserters have been shot as they were running away from the battlefield. So they have a line of people behind the front line of troops to shoot people if they run away. That's not the case everywhere, but there's video footage of that happening to Russian soldiers in Ukraine. So it really is a quite brutal approach to warfare that I'm not sure we would recognize in the West.
There are certain parts of Russian behavior which I don't understand, and I wonder if you could shed light on it.
If I understand them, I'll do my best.
One of them is why they haven't tried to intercept more the transfer of Western weapons to Ukraine, why they haven't used air power more, for example, to do that. I mean, they're stored in depots, and once some of these things cross the Polish border, they're up for grabs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got the range of weaponry, they could do it.
I agree. Yeah.
And why would they not do that? That's what I don't quite understand.
It's an obvious goal, right? You know, you strike at your enemy's logistics rather than their force, because it's much easier to destroy your enemy's tanks when they run out of fuel and ammunition because you've already destroyed their logistics, right? So one only assumes that the reason that the Russians aren't striking all of these supply lines coming in is because they can't. And why might they not be able to? Well, I can think of a few reasons. I don't have enough information but I can hypothesize. The first reason is that Russia has been under sanctions for quite a long time, since 2014, at least in the sense of this conflict, and obviously since February last year, under much heavier sanctions. That has limited Russia's ability to produce things like precision-guided missiles. So there's a kind of limited supply of precision-guided missiles that are able to do stuff like hit convoys or trains or whatever. If something's on the move, it's quite hard to hit it if you're in the air, but it's not at all difficult to hit it if you've got a precision, if you've got a guided thing, you just lock it on and fire it. And we've seen over the conflict, Russia started out with lots of cruise missile type things, and now it's using these Iranian-made drones, which are to a penny, because it's had to downgrade its level of technology as it's been fighting the conflicts. It's not able to produce enough high-end technology. So that is the first point, I think. The second point is, I'm not clear on how good Russia's intelligence is. So I think it's quite good when it comes to what's happening in eastern Ukraine in the battle space. I think there is pretty good Russian intelligence there. I don't know how good the intelligence is if you go to western Ukraine in Lviv, which is obviously a lot of the supplies are coming through that route. I don't know how good their, for example, aerial reconnaissance, satellite imagery, all that kind of stuff. You know, coming back to sanctions, we know that Russia's satellite constellations, they haven't been able to maintain them to the degree which they might have liked to over the last decade or so because of exactly this. So we don't know whether their intelligence is quite up to scratch. The final reason is Russian air power, right, has not been as impressive as everyone thought it would be. If you speak to air power experts, a lot of them say that the thing that Russia's had great difficulty with doing in this war is putting up packets of aircraft to achieve missions. So if they need to like fly a jet over the front line to like do one jet on one target, they can do that. But if you've got several jets, a complex package flying thousands of kilometers to hit a target, that's actually really complicated. You need hundreds of people, air traffic control, fighter controllers, armors, ground crews, all the rest. You know, it's a quite a complex organizational beast. And air power experts suppose that because Russia doesn't do that, really, they're very rare that you get Russian jets flying over eastern Ukraine. You know, they're not able to generate an air packet that's sufficient to dodge the Ukrainian air defenses, which are fairly reasonable at the moment. They've had a lot of support from the West. And the reason they're not doing it is because they're not able. They're too worried about losing the aircraft.
there's always a stage, isn't there, in all of these wars when people start to believe in a kind of Wunderwaffe, you know, a kind of miracle weapon system that will cure everything.
And yeah.
And we've had about three of those already, but now we're on the F-16s for Ukraine. And there's a lot of reservations about this. And why do you think that is? Is that a question about Western attitudes to training, thinking such a sophisticated bit of kit and very expensive bit of kit, you wouldn't put a pilot in without 8 months training?
Mm-hmm.
Is that really the case? I mean, isn't there a case for giving them F-16s early on? Or is it simply the fear, first of all, that the West itself would be humiliated if F-16s start dropping from the sky, and second, that the Ukrainians will misuse them and strike targets within Russia and bring NATO into the war?
Yeah, well, it's not a problem if F-16s start dropping out of the sky. It's a 50-year-old airframe. Mm,
yeah, quite, yeah.
So if the Russians can't shoot some of them down, then they're even worse than we thought they were. I mean, it's not like we're sending like stealth bombers or F-22s or whatever, you know, F-35s. So it's not that. I think there is a concern, as there has been with other weapon systems, that Ukraine will start to deploy these weapons on targets in Russia. And the thing is, at each stage, obviously, these weapons have been given to Ukraine and explicit guarantees have been sought from Ukraine that these won't be used inside Russia. And broadly, that's been followed. Of course, the problem is once you've given the weapon system over, we don't know at any point in the future they could just start to use them in Russia, right? If the West decides that, you know, well, we're not going to support Ukraine anymore, well, then Ukraine, the shadow of the future is very short for them, so they might decide. So I think that's one thing. I think the second thing is, you know, to my point about the complexity required to get a packet of aircraft, you know, if you used aircraft individually just shooting at the front line, they often get shot down, which is why we see a lot of these Russian planes getting shot down in eastern Ukraine, right? A guy with a SAM missile on his shoulder can take out a really expensive fighter jet. The way you use aircraft successfully is you put them in packets and then you know layer them and take out the air defenses first. And it's quite a complex thing. Of course, the Ukrainians could do it. The question is, can we help them develop that infrastructure or build on the infrastructure they already have so that they can integrate intelligence and targeting and all the rest of it to be able to use the weapon system successfully? And that's, you know, a bigger question, because these aren't going to be used to sort of hit the front line. These are going to be used to take out Russian arms depots within the territory of Ukraine, miles away. And in order to do that successfully, you need to fly across the front line, get through Russian air defenses, get your bombs on the targets. That requires intelligence, a whole bunch of layered capabilities in order to deliver that effect. It's really not as simple as just delivering the stuff. And if we look across the whole war, you know, at the beginning, we were sending them Javelin anti-tank missiles, right? That's literally a box. I could send you, Roger, a Javelin anti-tank missile. You could read the instructions and you'd be using it that day, right? I could send you on a training course, but you could figure it out. You're a smart guy.
Yeah, well.
And so on and so forth. Each level of equipment needs a little bit more training. So I think that's the concern.
And what about China? Yeah, it's talking big. It's pushing its ships around everywhere. It's got a huge army. But they haven't got that live fighting experience, not since the 1970s. And even the 1970s, they didn't have a very successful war against Vietnam, as I remember. So what do you think about that? Are some armies better at learning war than others? Are these lessons being taught properly? And what's going to happen in the future?
Answers
on a postcard.
I'll try and unpick some of that. With regard to China, you're right, they haven't fought a war for a long time. And they, like the Russians, have been going on a similar journey, which is to go from a manpower-intensive army to a technologically enhanced army, more akin to a Western one that could fight short, decisive wars. And the Chinese have been looking at the Russian experience in Ukraine going, oh, wow. Okay, we thought we were ready to take on Taiwan because we've got all these shiny bits of equipment and ships and we're really technologically advanced, but it's caused them to stop and think, if that happened to Russia and they were invading a next door country that is on the same rail network and it's gone so badly, what's going to happen to us if we try and invade across 100 miles of sea? You know, amphibious operations are the most complex operations that there are. To invade Taiwan, it's certainly given them pause for thought, because the lesson that the Chinese I think I've learned is kit is not sufficient to make an army. You know, a modern army obviously needs modern kit, but without the training, the doctrine, the morale, proper logistics, you know, strategy, all that stuff, the kit is just useless. They're just shiny targets. It's no different in the British Army or in the American Army in the sense of we often can't really learn from one war to the next. The mindset that you get into for one type of, say, a counterinsurgency war doesn't necessarily apply to, well, what the Russians are facing now, which is the first time they've actually had a serious state enemy since the Second World War, and they're getting absolutely pasted. So I think in summary, I would say that it's pretty difficult to learn from other wars, and all you're doing really is equipping people better so that they recognize quicker the mistakes that they're making and try and correct them on the fly. It's very, very difficult to learn from another war and to bring that experience into a war that you're just about to fight.
Yes. So I would like to know one source or text or film or book that you think influenced this book, the book that you've just written.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's written in the style of Machiavelli's The Prince.
Oh, yes.
I don't think that people are going to be reading this book in 500 years' time, although I really hope they are, although hopefully we won't be fighting wars in 500 years' time. But it's certainly written in that style. It didn't necessarily inspire it. What inspired it was watching the commentary on the Ukraine war, thinking, God, this is totally missing the point. And nobody actually was explaining in simple terms how to fight a war. And as I wrote the first chapter, I suddenly thought, now the best way to write this, actually the easiest way to write this, and hopefully the way that the reader finds most accessible, is to write it in the second person. So you need to do this, you need to think about this and that.
Yeah.
But I guess the comparisons end there between me and Machiavelli, but it's certainly written in that style.
You don't have Machiavelli's cynicism, I don't think. But you can work on that. Anyway, thank you very much, Mike. It was a pleasure, and I hope the book does really well.
Thank you, Roger. That's very kind.
Afterwards is produced by George McDonough. Thank you, George. And thank you to Mike Martin for taking part in this episode. You can buy a copy of How to Fight a War from the Hearst Publishers website. And for more, you can follow Hearst at Hearst Publishers, Mike at Threshed Thought, and me at Roger Boys on Twitter. And to get news on the latest Hearst books, subscribe to their email updates at hearstpublishers.com. And I'm Roger Boys, and thank you for listening.